All right, we're with Toni Morris at YAO 2011. We're in Brisbane now. Thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Thanks for having me. It's been great here at the conference.
I bet. Now, you're well known for your work in functional programming, and I mean, you're sort of in Brisbane, I'm told, is kind of a functional programming town.
Given our humble, small little town, we've got quite a large functional programming user group.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what you do with functional programming.
So I work for a product company not too far from here in Brisbane, and I use functional programming to ensure quick delivery times on our software, and most importantly that our software works. That turns out to be quite important.
Interesting. But I mean, you could argue that that's also true with imperative software. So what is it about functional programming that led you say something that you just did?
Functional programming, gives me the benefit of decomposing my problems such that I get a very clear delineation between each component of the software. Mm. And that leads me to, because I make mistakes a lot, I'm able to make mistakes in an isolated component in the software when I do and remedy that a lot quicker.
So are you talking about modularity or...?
Yeah, modularity, as most people are most familiar with, functional programming is quite powerful in terms of achieving that goal.
Excellent. And what programming language do you normally use that's functional?
Normally, if you're going to use that word, I would say Haskell.
Okay.
In terms of our product development, because we run inside environments like WebSphere Application Server, I use Scala. Mm. And I basically push that goal of modularity as hard as I can in that programming language without making too many sacrifices elsewhere.
Excellent. So what's the sort of basic unit of modularity? A function?
A function is the basic unit of modularity, and a function, as most people would probably be familiar with, the key distinguishing factor of a function in functional programming languages is that that function will only operate on its arguments, and there's no implied environment, as there might be in imperative programming where you can act on that environment.
Interesting. And so let's talk a little bit about some of the hard problems that you solve where functional programming really comes in handy.
Yep. For example, I recently solved a software product problem that had to run inside WebSphere, had to run on the DB2 Universal Database using JDBC, as most people are familiar with. JDBC is quite an imperative sort of API, and this sort of gives rise to the usual problems associated with that in terms of you lose modularity. So my task was to write a database layer in that environment, and we used a concept called iterates to solve that problem, which gives you composition and modularity without sacrificing on performance, which is quite important in the database application.
Absolutely. Now, in terms of the way that you interoperate with the database doesn't speak Scala, right?
That's right. No.
So how does that interoperation work?
Thankfully, since there was a JDBC layer Scala can just go right onto the JDBC layer, there wasn't too much work to do there. Mm. It was more like the inversion of control required in order to achieve the composition that was the challenging part.
Yeah.
I can think of lots of examples where you would get those advantages.
That's great. Interesting. Now, one of the things about functional programming as well is that it's very, it's very useful for mathematical computation. Is there, are people in the financial industry in Brisbane using functional languages? I mean, how is it actually manifesting itself in real-world usage?
So I guess I don't have too much, I'm not really in the financial circles too much here in Brisbane, although I do help out the Suncorp guys. It's a large bank here in Australia. I help those guys out. In that I teach them functional programming and why they might get the benefits from it, and whether they go away and compute their numbers so that they get the correct number at the end of the day, I'm actually not sure, but I should imagine they do that.
Interesting. So now, coming back to probably more interesting related to what you do, what's some of the hurdles that you're seeing with imperative developers that have been trained in an imperative mindset? So in your case, it's going to be Java guys.
Yeah.
What are some of the stumbling blocks you see them when trying to learn the functional way of thinking?
I mean, that's probably the biggest challenge that I find in this sort of space is, I guess, the educational aspect of it all. Mm-hmm. To answer your question specifically, it'd be something along the lines of when I do introduce these concepts, it appears clinical and boring and so on, until eventually there's this, they're called aha moments, where someone finally, they eventually understand the point. Mm-hmm. And from there it becomes a lot easier. But getting to that point where you solicit the trust of the person that you're teaching, it can be, people burn out easily.
Sure.
So it can be quite challenging.
Well, I mean, even if you think about sort of what Simon Peyton Jones was talking about in... there is going to be a learning curve, a pretty steep learning curve, to go from a non-functional way of thinking to a functional way of thinking.
Yes.
And so one could argue that an interesting approach would be to add that functional thinking, to interleave it into imperative programming languages. So if you see, like, with C#, for example, lambdas, you have link, which link mm-hmm. is definitely monadic in nature, right? Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's pretty much what it is.
Exactly.
Yep.
And so that's the way of getting sort of that functional kind of thinking or concepts into an imperative language, and so you don't have to teach
yep.
someone. So what are your thoughts on that?
I used to actually use that technique for teaching, and it's quite good to get, I guess, a quick soundbite off, because you don't need as much trust from the student.
Mm.
Where the student can immediately see the benefit of where you're going with that, but if the student is prepared to suspend disbelief for a little bit longer, and we can sort of hold off, I think the ultimate return on investment of that suspension of disbelief is much higher. And just being the kind of guy I am, I aim for that.
Yes.
Getting right up there. Yeah.
Good. Well, I mean, you're here teaching. You're doing workshops.
Yep.
So what's your workshop?
My workshop, basically, the title is Introduction to Pure Functional Programming. I use Haskell for that, and I run it in accordance with the students and what they want to get out of it. Just the other day in Melbourne, I had 15 people who have no experience of functional programming at all. And I guess at the end of the day, if I send them home with a headache, I've succeeded. And and they told me I've got a sore head at
yeah.
5 o'clock. So,
but I mean, in some sense, that's sort of what I would argue needs to be eliminated, in the sense that there should be a bridge between conceptual models. Such
yeah.
that if I'm a Java developer or a C# developer and I need to go functional because it makes the most sense, I don't have to sort of, open up my head and just kind of start, twiddling with my brain to get
yeah.
to the state where I can figure this out. I mean, how do you make it, understandable, comprehensible?
I do actually exploit existing knowledge of programmers in terms of, if I've got, say, Java guys in front of me, like I did the other day, I'll kind of show the analogies between what they're currently doing and, where I'm going with functional programming, and then we can kind of introspect on that and look at the benefits that we've got. And because that sort of the leap is quite small in comparison to those that we might usually make, it gives the students something to kind of think about without me having to guide them, because they're already there.
Excellent. Now, one of the things that's also must be challenging for you is when you go from a world where it's all about side effects
yes.
to a world where side effects are not only, they're not revered at all, let's put it that way. So how
yeah.
does that work from the standpoint of, like, I want to write to a file, man. I want to open up a file, change it, write to it, close it.
Yeah, I'll just take what you just said. You want to open up a file, which is an I/O operation, and then I'll just think of something simple, like you might want to reverse the contents of the file. That is not an I/O operation. And then you want to write to the file, which again is an I/O operation. And in terms of how we model that exactly as how I just said it, and that is, we take an I/O operation. The read file does not just give me the contents of the file; it gives me the contents of the file inside I/O. And then the reverse function, which would reverse the contents of the file, is not in an I/O operation. And we model it exactly like that. And then, again, we write we write the contents of the file. But you can actually think of that as in a pure functional way, in that you know, the file comes in, you've got the contents, and now that you've got the contents, you reverse, and then you take that and then you write. And that entire thing is like a state transitioning until at the very end you see the file that's been written with your contents reversed. And that's basically, we just model it as I just said it. And it's really not as unfamiliar as is often made out.
Okay, fair enough. But I think the thing that trips people up a lot is the concept of a monad.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I mean, that must be very confusing to imperative types who don't have a mathematical background or something in lambda calculus. So what's the definition of a monad?
The definition of a monad, just a clinical definition, I guess, is that it's an interface that supports certain operations, and there are a bunch of data structures that happen to support that interface, and because of that, there's a bunch of also a library of operations that are given, that arise from that interface, and because there's all these instances, they automatically pick up all of that library.
Excellent.
And that's a clinical definition. The practical implications of that are a little bit harder to explain, mostly because they're just so enormous. It really is quite a practical interface.
Sure.
I'm happy to do that.
Do it.
Just take a while. Most programmers are familiar with sort of coming up with an interface, implementing that interface, and then, deriving operations because of that. An example I can think of is comparing objects for order. If your object can be compared for order, you can sort a list of those things. I think most people are familiar with that. Just imagine now that there's many, many operations that you could do, not just sorting, and just imagine that there's many, many things that can be compared. I think it could be argued that's a very useful thing. And so that's the practical implications of monads. In terms of, but I don't see that in my programming every day. That's more just a pattern recognition thing.
Sure.
You probably are using that pattern. It's just that once you start recognizing it, you can start exploiting those practical implications.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just another sort of educational issue rather than a practical one.
Sure. And then the rest is essentially syntax. Right.
Yeah, and then there's languages have different syntax support. I know Scala and Haskell, the two languages I use, and even C# has syntax support for doing monadic computation. And even languages that don't do it, you can exploit the fact to the best ability that the language provides.
What is it like actually building your own monadic structure?
Unfortunately, many languages don't have a type system that supports the general abstraction. Scala and Haskell are two statically typed languages that do. And of course, if you turn the static type system off, you can just do whatever you like.
Sure.
But in terms of when it comes to languages like Java or C#, and you try and just implement that general library, you're in for a bit of a battle. So depending on which environment you're in is probably how I might answer that question.
Sure. So let's look at the environment that you're in. So
when I'm in Scala, for example, when I write a data structure, I determine whether or not it is a monad. I can usually I can just do that intuitively. Sometimes I have to get a bit of peer review or perhaps even write a little proof. But once I've got that, I'll implement that interface, and I know immediately that I've now got access to that to the monad library. And to go back to the example of the database application, there was quite emphatically a really useful monad in that the function that takes a regular database connection and produces a value has a name. It's called the reader monad, and I didn't have to write a proof. I could see that immediately,
okay.
And I just threw that all together and said to the guys that we're using my interface. I said, there you go, there's a useful library for you. And off they went. I didn't have to say the word monad.
Excellent. That's a key. Because that really does throw a lot of people for a loop.
It does. Some people have called them spacesuits, or I call them fluffy clouds in my functional programming course.
Excellent. Well, I like the way you defined it as an interface, because that immediately makes sense.
It really is. That's really all it is. It's just that certain type systems don't model it very well, so it becomes a bit foreign if we were to use those type systems. But other than that, it's perfectly familiar.
So now, in terms of pure functional programming, let's try to explain to people why one functional programming language can be considered pure and another one not.
Okay, well, I can use Haskell and Scala as contrasting examples there. So Haskell being the pure functional programming language, I guess I'll take Scala, which is impure. Mm. If you take, for example, the reverse function on a list, or I'm sure we can think of all these list examples, or just functions that don't do any I.O., the Scala type system does not denote the fact that it doesn't do any I.O. So if I ask you, or if I ask someone to go away and write a reverse function, they have to sort of write in a comment at the top and sort of sign off on a bit of paper with a promise that says, no, I don't do any I.O. Whereas in the Haskell type system, all I need to do is look at the type of your function, and I can see immediately that you haven't done any I.O. or it would not have compiled. Mm. And so you just wouldn't be giving me a compiling program.
Sure.
So a pure functional programming language forces you to be pure, and when you're doing I.O., you have to own up. It forces honesty, ultimately.
Okay. And so, but, you know, this is interesting, because, I mean, what is it about I.O. in this case that, you know, makes it pure that I let you know that I.O. is going to happen when you call this function?
So in order to determine, the key defining factor of a pure functional programming language is that it all functions exhibit the property of referential transparency. And that's just a great big buzzword or scary word for the fact that your equations evaluate to their values. So if I said something like, x equals print line such and such, wherever x appears, I can go and replace it with print line and nothing changes. And so in Haskell, the print function is an I.O. function. Mm. And all it does is, I.O. is sort of an action that's going to run, and when it does, it's in this case going to print line.
Okay.
But it basically becomes a first-class imperative program, if you like, that I can pass around. And it's actually quite a powerful imperative programming language when you introduce an I.O. in the type.
Excellent. An I.O. monad.
If you want to, I.O. in general, which just happens to be a monad, and many other useful things.
Sure.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the fact that it's a monad guarantees what?
Just that it's got a very useful library. To give you an example of a library function, if you've got a list normally think about it, of I.O. actions, so I might just say print line, open the database connection, write to the file, close the database connection, and this is a list. I can actually just say, run all of that list of actions and give me the list of results that might come about from that.
Okay.
And this function actually runs on any monad, not just I.O. Mm. And it is this library function and many other library functions I could describe to you that give you the useful bit. Because you don't have to keep writing that function over and over again for all the different monads. You've got it for I.O., you've got it for state, you've got it for reader, you've got it for all the other different monads. It's just one function defined somewhere. Mm. You can just call it.
Excellent. Now, in terms of people who may say that you can't use Haskell, say, to build a website or to build a client application or to build some UI. I mean, UI is side effectual, right?
It is.
So is there a UI monad that you have to...
UI is a bit of a sad story when it comes to Haskell, but that's just a consequence of the missing libraries. Mm. So I'm going to kind of ignore that question and talk about web application development.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah, so I mean, when it comes to web application development, Haskell is hands down the winner.
Really?
Absolutely, no doubt about it. So there's things like YeaSide and Snap Framework coming through now, and they exploit functional programming techniques such as iterates and so on that allow you to keep the performance and keep all the, they allow you to express abstractions that are required in web application development without sacrificing all the other, I guess, bad bits. You don't need those anymore, right?
Okay.
All the bugs and so on. So I guess a common complaint I do come up against is that, web applications are I.O. heavy and so on. How do I do this in my pure functional programming language? And the answer is, well, you just model it exactly as I.O. heavy as it in fact is. Mm. And so I mean, I can give you a very simple web application that might say read in the HTTP request in I.O., read in from the database in I.O., then it does this great big transformation on the data and then writes out the response. There's only three little I.O. bits there. The rest is not in I.O., and you model it exactly like that. I'm sure you can think of many data transformations that might happen in a web application.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're constructing the markup to send back down and data bind it, as you were explaining, I mean, that's typically what happens in a web page, right?
That's right. And so, I mean, all pure functional programming does is it kind of it delays the hasty reaching for side effects. It's sort of like, no, I don't actually need one yet. Let's not go there yet. And it delays that right until the last moment when eventually, yes, you do. You've got to write the response or whatever it might be.
Functional programming has been around for a long time, yet it's still not in the mainstream. Even though we see bits of functional programming moving into mainstream languages, I mean, there's lambdas in C++, for example.
Yep.
And can you talk a little bit about why is that? In your opinion, why is that the case?
It's just, I guess, people go through university and they get taught Java and so on, and some people just sort of stop discovering, I guess. If you do, you just kind of, you know, look around a bit further, maybe try out Haskell or functional programming is independent of any language.
Sure.
If you sort of just try out this different way of thinking and then take a look at the benefits you might get from that. There's no one really to motivate anyone. The reason you're seeing it, I think that you're seeing it's becoming a bit more popular is because this motivation is now here, because it's companies are working out that it's costing them money because their applications don't work. So there's that motivation, kind of my work's being done for me there. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to help push that because I want our programs and libraries to work as well, as much as anyone else does.
Absolutely. Now, we do live in a world where you have multiple systems communicating and working together. The most canonical example is the database and the tier before it, so like the web application.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very different models. Mm-hmm. How does it work when you have interoperation between a Java application and a Scala application, or a Haskell application? How does that interchange work?
There are various difficulties presented just by that alone.
Sure.
Yeah,
it's hard.
It is quite hard, yeah.
But it's a heterogeneous world, right?
That's right. I guess the aim is not to aim for some kind of utopian ideal or anything. It's basically to just work within your constraints.
Mm.
And that may be that you've got to work within some sort of Java framework or whatever it might be.
Mm.
The technique of functional programming basically does not aim for any high ideal. It just says, well, what's the best we can achieve within that constraint?
Mm-hmm.
And if there's some imposition by some Java library that you're using, you just take it on the chin and sort of mark it on your scorecard. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pay that penalty, and you move on.
Excellent. But I really do hope that universities start to diversify a little more in their basic educational framework, and not everyone has to learn Java. I mean, regardless, if it's C#, Java, or C, or whatever, the functional stuff is very interesting in this world of concurrency and parallelism as well, obviously, because you need to model those systems.
So, I mean, in a parallel system, just quite simply, if you're the type of your function denotes that it doesn't perform any side effect, it's obvious now that you can perform that in any order, which would be great on, multi-core processors.
Yeah.
It's quite an obvious implication.
Certainly. And the shared nothing model is good. Shared nothing. Right on, man.
Share nothing.
Hey, great to meet you.
Yeah.
And good luck with your workshops, and thanks for doing that.
Thanks very much for having me.
Right on, man. Take care.